Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
Richard Stearns was once the CEO of a multi-million dollar luxury goods company. He was on a huge salary. He drove a Jaguar to work every day. Then a team of headhunters, including the well-known megachurch pastor Bill Hybels, changed everything one day when they offered him the job as president of World Vision USA. Now, it's a decision that he agonized over at the time. It would mean a 75% pay cut. But now, 11 years later, Richard Stearns says he wouldn't change a thing. His experiences and lessons he's learnt during that time in the job have actually inspired him to write a book called The Hole in Our Gospel. It's going to be a bit of a prod to Christians, I believe. Richard is on the line now. Richard, welcome to Open House.
Thank you, Sheridan.
You know, going from a large pay packet like that, driving a Jaguar to work, and then having a phone call one day from this group of people thinking that you might be the next president of World Vision USA. Tell me about that phone call, tell me about that day, and tell me about your emotional response to their approach.
Well, it was one of those bizarre moments in life that you look back on. As it turns out, it was a moment that changed my life. But I was in my office at this luxury goods company, and my administrative assistant said there's an executive recruiter or a headhunter on the line, and I took the call because you always wonder if there's something better out there. And he was doing the search to find the next CEO of World Vision for the U.S., and after 20 minutes of boilerplate, here's the job, here's what we're looking for, and he asked me if I knew anybody that fit that description. And I knew about World Vision. It's a large charity in the United States, as it is in Australia. Mm. And my wife and I had been significant donors to the organization. So I said to him, that is a difficult job to fill because, as I see it, you're looking for someone who's part CEO, part Mother Teresa, and part Indiana Jones. And I said, I don't know how you're going to find that combination. Well, the recruiter, basically, we talked a little bit longer, and then he said, well, what about you? Would you be interested in the job? And I gave kind of a nervous laugh, and I said, me? I don't have any of the qualifications that you're looking for. I don't know anything about international relief and development. I don't know anything about fundraising. I have no theological background. I know World Vision is a faith-based organization. Basically, as the conversation went, he insisted on having dinner with me. I kept saying no, but he insisted that, you know, he just wanted a couple of hours of my time to present his case and to get to know me a little better. So reluctantly, I had dinner with him. And I'll never forget the question he asked. He asked me, are you willing to be open to God's will for your life? And, you know, I had been a Christian for many, many years, and I talked a good game. I talked the talk. And I think he was asking, are you willing to walk the walk of, you know, put your money where your mouth is? Here's an opportunity to serve and to live out your values in a real dramatic way that might help a lot of other people.
There is certainly a role for the wealthy person to donate what they have to organizations like World Vision or whoever else it might be. But it's easy to just give the money, isn't it? And actually not say, right, God has every bit of my life, no matter what it's going to be, even if it actually means a 75% pay cut.
Well, that's right. I mean, if you had told me a week before that call that I should give not 10% of my income to the church and the work of the church and the work of international development, but I should give 75%, I would have laughed at you and said, I couldn't possibly give 75% of my income because of all of these obligations I have, and I have five children I have to put through college. And yet, at the end of the day, obviously I did end up accepting the job a few months later, and I came to World Vision, and I did take that pay cut, and I'm still here, and I'm still not doing without, and I lead a very comfortable life. So it was possible to sacrifice at a deeper level, even though I probably didn't think it would have been. So you're right. You can write a check and keep the poor at an arm's length distance. But I think God calls us to get involved in the lives of the poor in more than a token way, and that's what he was calling me to do.
Let's go back to your earlier years. What did you want to be when you were growing up? I mean, did you always have kind of your eyes set on being a CEO of a large company and driving a Jaguar?
Well, actually, I did. And that was part of the problem. When I grew up in a relatively poor family, I had parents that never went to high school. When I was 10, my parents divorced, and the bank foreclosed on our house as my father declared bankruptcy because of his drinking problems. So I had a very insecure childhood, and against all odds, I was able to attend two Ivy League schools in the United States, Cornell and the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School for an MBA. And I did it all on loans and scholarship and summer jobs. And so when I became a CEO at age 33, it was the American dream. I mean, I had gone from rags to riches, and I was so amazed that I'd been able to do that. That's what made it so difficult when World Vision came knocking, because I had to essentially say, I'm willing to give all that up. Mm. I'm willing to walk away from that career, which I'd worked at for 23 years, and take that risk and step out on faith. And that's why the decision was so difficult for me.
Mm-hmm. What made you or helped you to finally make the decision, yes, I'm going to take up this offer?
Well, you know, ultimately, as a follower of Jesus Christ, the Bible has some pretty hard teaching about our responsibility for our fellow man. I mean, I think every religion has the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, or love your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus actually was quite serious about that. He was quite serious that when you're driving a Jaguar and living in a mansion and other people don't have food to eat, there's something wrong with that, and he calls us, who are followers, to do something about that, to live differently in the world. You know, I was confronted with that challenge to my faith, that if you really believe this, then you need to act on it. And there's this passage in the New Testament, the story of the rich young ruler, where he asks Jesus if he lacks anything. You know, this is a very successful young guy that's doing all the right things, going to temple and doing the right thing. And he says, do I lack anything? And Jesus looks at him and says, sell everything you have and give it to the poor and come and follow me, and then you will have treasure in heaven. And I felt like that rich young man. I felt like God was saying, Rich, look at you. I want you to sell metaphorically everything you have and come and give it to the poor and follow me. And that was a tough call to make, and I didn't do it with a lot of joy in my heart at the time, but it's been the greatest decision I ever made.
Mm. This is Open House right across the nation, theopenhouse.net.au, for our podcast of our chat with Richard Stearns, president of World Vision USA, author of The Hole in Our Gospel. Going to get to the book in just a minute. So a couple of months after taking up the job, you then jump on a plane and you go and visit Uganda to see the AIDS pandemic over there. Tell us what you saw and how it affected you.
Well, if you can imagine, literally 60 days after leaving my Jaguar and the corporate boardroom behind, this frightened CEO, the new CEO of World Vision, goes to the middle of the AIDS pandemic in Africa, in Rakai, Uganda. And I had never been to Africa. I had never seen grinding poverty like I saw there. And I was taken into the household of three boys, 13, 10, and 11, who had lost both of their parents to AIDS. Presumably it was AIDS. Mm. They were living alone. They were what was called a child-headed household. I had never heard of such a thing, but it was because both parents had died. They had no aunts and uncles or grandmothers or grandfathers that could care for them. So they lived totally alone in this mud hut, no electricity, no one to feed them, no one to get them off to school, no one to break up their little boyhood fights. I felt like I had been punched in the stomach. You know, how could this be happening in our world? And my first reaction was, Lord, forgive me, I didn't know. I didn't know that this was happening. Mm. But then I realized I really did know. I chose to turn the other way. I read the newspapers. I read the magazines. I listen to the media. I know that children are hungry and alone and orphaned and dealing with difficult, difficult circumstances. But for me, up until that moment, I could always write a check to keep them outside my bubble that I lived in the United States. But that day, in that place, I couldn't escape the reality of what I think God wanted me to see. And that's where I think the seed was planted for my book, The Hole in Our Gospel, because the word gospel means good news. The gospel was supposed to be good news to the world. And I asked myself, what good news have these boys felt from the gospel? What good news have they felt from those that go to churches in America and Australia and Europe? And I realized that many of us in America, and including myself, had embraced a gospel with a gaping hole in it, that we were missing the social justice piece that Jesus demanded.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about then what the gospel does mean to you then, because we can come from two or three different angles on this depending on our church background, if we have a church background. One, of course, is the evangelical tradition, which I've been a part of. Sounds like you probably have too, where the John 3:16 tradition, that the gospel is God so loved the world that he gave his only son that we could have eternal life by believing in him, because he has paid for our personal sins. He's taken the penalty for those so we can go free. We can enjoy an eternity with God, both here but also in heaven. Then I guess you could have the more mainstream liberal approach to the gospel that says it's not so much about a life in heaven with God after you die. It's about bringing some social relief to people right here and now. Then there's other approaches to it, the liberation gospel and all those kinds of approaches. Some of them have got part of the truth, some of them have got none of the truth, some of them maybe have more truth than others. How do you understand this phrase, the gospel, now? How do you define it these days?
Well, I think that's exactly the problem. I think many different groups have embraced a part of the gospel, but not the whole gospel, W-H-O-L-E. And my contention is that the good news was never meant to be just a private transaction between me and God. And I think many of us treat it that way. It's a private transaction. We say a few words. We make a commitment in our heart and with our words to the Lord to follow him. We accept Jesus' death on the cross as our saving grace. And then we go right back to whatever party we were at, and we don't change anything in our lives, and we just go about our business feeling like we've got this fire insurance policy in our drawer, and when we die, we're going to go to heaven. Well, to me, that's a gospel with a hole in it. And I think as you read the New Testament, I use Luke chapter 4 as one of my proof texts in the book, but Jesus talks in Luke chapter 4 about three elements of the good news. First is the proclamation element, that Christ has come, the Son of God has come to die for us and save us from our sins. The second part is compassion, that we are going to demonstrate compassion on our fellow man. Jesus was always healing the lame, restoring sight for the blind, caring for the sick, touching the leper. He set an example for us. And then the third piece is biblical justice, that we're to stand for what's right. We're to stand up for the weak and the powerless, to be a voice for the voiceless. And when you put those three things together, proclamation, compassion, and justice, now you've got a glimpse of the good news, that it was meant to be good news for the entire world. And had the power to change our world.
That's a very good way that you've put that, because so often, as we've been talking, we actually focus on one of those three. We either come from the proclamation tradition or focus just on compassion, and so there's no kind of calling people to consider this person of Jesus and his cosmic reconciliation that he did for us because of our sin, our rebellion against God, or the justice thing. We're very much into action, very much into writing letters for oppressed groups, but we don't see the other aspects as well, bringing them all three together. All three together, though, for each individual Christian. Now, that really is a challenge, isn't it?
Well, it is a challenge, and I think at the root of it is the question of what kind of commitment did you make to God when you gave your life to Christ? Was it a partial commitment that I'm going to give you a little bit of my life, I'm going to write you a little check, every month, or did you give it all? Did you say, my entire life, my career, my family, my marriage, my thoughts, my actions, my money, it's all in your service, Lord? That kind of all-in, sold-out, bet-the-farm commitment is what I think is required of Christians. There's a chilling verse in Luke chapter 6, I believe it is, where Jesus looks at some of those who claim to follow him, and he asks this question. He says, why do you call me Lord, Lord, but you do not do what I say? Now, I find that chilling. He goes on to say in Matthew chapter 7, an account of the same encounter, many will come to me on that day and say, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy and perform miracles in your names? And Jesus says, I will say to you on that day, I never knew you. Get away from me, you evildoers. In other words, Jesus was saying that what we do, the kind of commitment we made to him, will become evident to him based on what we've done with our lives and how we've invested our lives on his behalf.
Mm. Richard Stearns is the president of World Vision USA. We're hearing his story of moving from a very high-paid corporate CEO driving a Jaguar to work every day to then becoming the CEO of World Vision and discovering that for those of us who call ourselves Christians, sometimes there really is a hole in our gospel. That's actually the title of his new book, The Hole in Our Gospel, where we've neglected certain aspects of what God has actually called us to do. Theopenhouse.net.au for the podcast. So, Rich, how do we then start to move our lives to being that the kind of whole Christians that you're talking about, W-H-O-L-E, where we are all about proclamation and compassion and justice? Some would actually say that in practice, when you start bringing social justice into the whole idea of what it means to be a Christian, that often one of the others, normally proclamation, actually gets lost. In fact, there has been criticisms about World Vision in that regard, that they haven't had so much of a proclamation aspect to their work over the last few years, and then there's been moves to try and restore that. What's your thoughts about that?
Well, I hear those criticisms as well, and I think perhaps St. Francis said it well. He's attributed to have said, preach the gospel always, use words if necessary. Mm. The notion of it is this, that the gospel or the good news or the good news of God's love for each of us is better demonstrated than spoken. Now, ideally, it's both. It is demonstrated first and then spoken. But World Vision believes you have to earn the right to share your faith with another person from another culture. You don't just barge in and say, here's a Bible and here's what you need to believe, and if you don't believe this, you'll burn in hell, and then leave. You go in and you demonstrate through tangible acts of compassion and mercy and justice, walking with these people in their own culture, caring about their children and their families, helping them shoulder to shoulder to solve their problems, to tackle the causes of the things that keep them in poverty. Mm. And maybe 2 years later, 5 years later, 10 years later, you've earned the right to have a conversation with that person about your faith and what motivates you. We try to lead with our love and our concern for people, and if they want to talk about faith, that question usually emerges somewhere down the road. And we're all about freedom of religion. I know in America that's an important principle for us. People are free to choose their own religious beliefs, but there's also a marketplace of ideas, and we also have the freedom to express those other ideas in that marketplace, as long as we express them in appropriate, contextually appropriate ways, sensitive ways.
Well, even the story that we started off with, you were talking about the three brothers that you met over in Uganda, who were starving, who had no parents around to look after them. You needed to do something very physical and very practical to help their immediate need right from that point on, rather than whip out a Bible and just say, look, you can have eternity in heaven. So then reorienting our lives to this kind of holistic approach to the gospel, the good news, first of all will be the question, okay, what do I do? Not everybody can actually jump on a plane and go and help orphans, go and help those three brothers. What can we do to start reorienting our lives around this holistic gospel of both proclamation, compassion, and justice, without just resorting to what we were talking about before, the writer check ministry, alone?
I'd say a couple of things. First of all, to really be serious about these things takes some discipline and some intentionality. I say in my book that if you want to lose 30 pounds, you actually have to change your behavior. You have to be intentional about going to that gym every morning. You have to be intentional about counting calories and changing your diet. And if you are diligent and intentional and focused and you change your behavior, lo and behold, you'll lose that 20 or 30 pounds over time. The same thing is true of living a life where you invest in issues of compassion and justice in our world. So it might start with giving. There's nothing wrong with writing a check. In fact, when you come from a wealthy nation, if you don't write a check, you're a bit of a hypocrite because you have more than most people in the world have. Mm-hmm. So you can't avoid the financial question. And so how do you do that? You might say, well, what percentage of my income am I devoting to helping others that are less fortunate, or am I devoting to justice issues, or whatever your humanitarian social issue might be that you're passionate about. If you're giving 1% of your income, you know, can you take it to 2? If you're giving 2, can you take it to 4? And can you, over a period of several years, increase the level of your giving to that cause? Number two, you have to look at what your gifts and talents and abilities are. Are you a nurse or a doctor? Well, you might be able to use those skills on a volunteer basis. Maybe if you're a business person or a financial whiz or someone that's involved in strategic planning, you might offer your services to a small nonprofit that would really benefit from your services. Mm-hmm. You might have a gift of compassion or mercy where you can work in an AIDS hospice and comfort the sick. You might minister to the elderly in a nursing home who just want some company and someone to read to them a couple of times a week. So you have to build that in too, your time and your talents. And do I devote, you know, several hours a week or a day a month to doing this kind of thing, and how do I get involved? So I think each of us, it's a different answer. You might be a natural advocate, write to your elected officials, influence legislation and policy that will help people in other places or right within your own community. So there's a lot of ways. The only thing that's not excused is to do nothing. Mm-hmm. And I think we just have to be more intentional and disciplined about our engagement.
And this goes back again to that radical call, if we are Christians, that radical call that Jesus has on our lives to give our whole lives to him. And that might actually be just like you, where you're actually called to leave quite a well-off position and actually go and live on less to do so much more for what he's actually calling you to do. Rich, let's finish up on dreams and visions for the future. I mean, World Vision as a whole looks after all sorts of hunger and poverty-related programs, the AIDS crisis, looking after folks that have been the victims of war, refugees, child soldiers, malaria, tuberculosis programs, water and sanitation programs. What's your dream for World Vision for the next couple of years? Where would you like to see the organization do more? And what's your personal dream? Where would you like to see yourself in a few years' time?
Well, first of all, I don't think one organization can solve the world's problems when it comes to poverty and justice issues. And that's why we often talk a lot at World Vision about creating a movement of people. We're never going to live in a utopia, but we used to have a phrase a few years ago, we still use it at World Vision, that we dream of a world that will no longer tolerate poverty. Mm-hmm. I like to think we're in a world, we're moving toward a world where we no longer tolerate racism and bigotry. We're moving toward a world that will no longer tolerate pollution and energy consumption and the kinds of things that are damaging our planet, biodiversity loss. And I hope that we can be a people that will no longer tolerate a world filled with poverty and injustice, as much as we can do to change it within our power. Mm. But it's going to take lots and lots of people speaking on these issues and making these commitments, and organizations like World Vision, and sound policies from governments. And I believe that we can see a change. We have seen a change. The number of children dying every day of preventable causes has fallen in half over the last 40 years, even though world population has grown pretty dramatically. So we are making a difference. It does matter. We are saving lives, and we have to be grateful for that and celebrate that while we strive to do better.
Richard, good to talk to you. Thanks for your time on Open House tonight.
Well, thank you, and please say hello to my good friend Tim Costello there when you get a chance.
Well, Tim's joining us on the show quite often these days, so we indeed may well get a chance to. Richard Stearns, USA's World Vision President, author of The Hole in Our Gospels through Thomas Nelson Books.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.